Well, good evening and welcome to this live show, this special live show on the 26th of January 2022. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on the show, and thanks very much for sparing some of your holiday day with us. Very interesting conversation, important conversation tonight about Russia and what's really going on. And I'll bring Robbie in just a second. He's teed up and ready to go. But just as I always do, if I may just remind you that we don't provide specific legal or financial advice or anything on this channel. It's a general conversation. Do please play nice in the chat room. The stream is moderated. This is as at the 26th of January 2022 if you're watching in replay. And if you want to ask a question, use @walktheworld to get my attention. I do encourage you to have lots of chat going on, but I don't necessarily follow all of those chat streams. But if you use @walktheworld, then there's a very good chance that your question will get my attention. But also, if you would like to make sure it does, then you can use the super chat, and that gets your question top of the list. Or indeed, if you'd like to make a contribution to the running of what we do here. We do it because we think there are some important issues to talk about, not to make a profit. And with that, and without further ado, I'm going to bring Robbie in. Robbie, are you there?
I am. Good evening, Martin.
Hello, Robbie. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm good on this Australia Day.
No, it's good to see you there. And I got to ask you that question. There's a sticky on your wall. What on earth is a sticky doing on your wall there?
Well, you can bear witness to this, Martin, because you saw it. A few minutes ago, my 10-year-old son raced up and stuck this to the wall and then raced off again because, of course, he's under orders to be quiet for the next hour and a half. So what does it say? It says, you might not see that. I'll read it to you. It says, "Be nice, cookie boy."
Be nice, cookie boy. I love it.
So I hope that message gets through. My son has paid attention to some of these shows over the last few years.
Very good. Okay, well, that's good. Well, the cookie boy, of course, was the catalyst for this conversation. And actually, I do think it's a very important conversation because there is a lot of stuff whizzing around with regards to Russia and, you know, what's going on, what's not going on. You know, just to give you a bit of a flavour, The Guardian came out and said, has the West fallen for Putin's tricks on Ukraine, which is an interesting way to frame it. We had The Australian, which said flexing US muscles over Ukraine is the best way to deter alpha male Vladimir Putin. Yep. Yeah. We had this one, which I thought was quite interesting on 7 News. Biden will consider personal sanctions on President Putin. So, you know, it's getting personal. This one here, which was that why are Germany and France, is from The Guardian, at odds with the Anglosphere. And in other words, not even within NATO, within Europe, is there a common view. There's the so-called Normandy group, which includes France and some other ones. And then the last one from the strategists, the ASPI, will the West abandon Ukraine? So, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff going on, right, from all sorts of different angles and directions. And I suppose the key question, and what I wanted to try and start exploring with you, Robbie, is how do we get a clear reading on, you know, what's really going on? And clearly at the moment there is a very strong sense in the West in particular, and, you know, with the UK and with NATO and the USA of, you know, Putin's basically, you know, upsetting everybody. He's trying to actually exert his power and influence. On the other hand, Russia is saying, well, hang on a moment, you know, you're nibbling away at my borders, and I want to protect those borders. So there's a bunch of sort of interplay. So I guess to start the conversation, how do we try and unpick this?
Well, why don't we do this? Let's just as a mental exercise, let's start from the fact that there's two countries the United States could pick a war with that could end in thermonuclear conflagration of the world. One of those is Russia, one of those is China. And when you think of it that way, then you think, okay, Well, let's actually take very, very seriously what happens in the tensions that involve those two countries. There's other flashpoints in the world, of course, and dangers, et cetera, but nothing compares to what the outcome of those two conflicts would be. Could be, not necessarily would be, but could be. And because they could be, if you stick your head in the sand and think, oh, no, we're protected by MAD, mutually assured destruction, it'll never happen, right? You just rationalize away that they've spent cajillions on these ICBMs, but oh, they'll never use them. You're kidding yourself, to be honest. You actually have to take that danger very seriously. And the serious statesmen that I've talked to over the years have always taken that danger very, very seriously. So when you do, then you don't think, you don't have the luxury of just looking at Vladimir Putin as some kind of tin pot dictator, wannabe Hitler. In the year 2000, in Murdoch's Herald Sun here in Melbourne, one of his columnists said Vladimir Putin is the new Hitler. I mean, it's a cheap thing to say. It's the tenor of what's been thrown around about Putin over the years. But then, of course, every latest target of Anglo-American regime change is always the new Hitler. Xi Jinping's now the new Hitler. You know, if Saddam Hussein was once the new Hitler, it gets overused. But you wouldn't look at it that way. You would say, okay, what's actually really at stake here? And that's the way we look at it. And because we look at it that way, we are highly motivated, Martin, and you're talking to a political party that's been in operation for 32 years in Australia, and we have a very productive association with like-minded organisations around the world, including I have a friend, a woman I spent the night with on vodka, drinking vodka, chili flavored vodka, who is a Ukrainian politician named Natalia Vitrenko, and you get to have real analysis and real insight into what's going on here, unblinded by the idea that everything we do, our side does by definition, has to be right, because it's just not true. And so when you take those blinkers off, you see a very, very different picture than has emerged from those clippings that you just highlighted. And you get a little bit of an insight into why France and Germany, who are the biggest powers in Europe and therefore the biggest European powers in NATO, only the United States and the United Kingdom are a greater force in NATO, why France and Germany are not going along with this. And that's the number one thing that should register with people. Why is that, right? What are they seeing being there in the firing line, frankly, that you're not getting from the disgusting propaganda pumped out faithfully by the Murdoch press and the sycophantic establishment press in Australia that just echoes what's pumped out in the United States and the United Kingdom? This is very, very seriously. Take the danger of war seriously, and then let's actually unpack what's going on. And essentially, what's going on is that 30 years ago, the United States made a promise to Russia that it broke. And subsequently, it has made multiple promises to Russia that it has broken, each one involving infringements on Russia's security that America wouldn't tolerate if the shoe was on the other foot. And now, under Vladimir Putin, and 22 years into Vladimir Putin's presidency, by the way, roughly, you know, with that break in between, Putin has, his patience is at an end, and Russia's not going to accept any more lies. And Russia has said, this is it. We want you to agree to a treaty that guarantees our security through guaranteeing the neutrality of Ukraine, that Ukraine will never join NATO. And if you don't, all bets are off. And that guarantee that Russia's asking for is in writing what it was promised in 1990. Because in 1990, it peacefully stood by while the Soviet Union, it allowed all the smaller republics of the Soviet Union to break away. And it was done peacefully, and it was done in an orderly fashion, right? And it was a big challenge for a nation like Russia to accept that, but it did. But accepted it on certain conditions, and they've all been broken. And now we are at a flashpoint because of that 30-year history of lying. And when we get some time, I'd like to go through some of the specific examples of that.
Yeah, Robbie, just let me come in there because it's an interesting observation. There are six countries that have a, quote, special relationship with the European Union, right? Ukraine is one of those six, right? And basically that is a sort of a pre-positioning of, you know, maybe down the track joining into the Eurozone. So basically what you've got is you've got people from you know, the West reaching out towards Ukraine. You've got Russia reaching out towards Ukraine. They're caught in the middle. And interestingly, I was listening to an interview from the US today. In fact, the ambassador for Ukraine in the US talking about the fact that Ukraine wants to be able to make its own decision about its future, right? But I did find out that they actually got about $650 million worth of arms from the US in the last little while, and more's coming. So we know that America's flowing, materials into Ukraine to help them arm up. And the other interesting observation that she made was that when Ukraine was part of USSR the first time around all those years ago, you know, there were huge millions of deaths over a period of time in Ukraine. So there is a very checkered history for Ukraine as well in its relationships with Russia. It's not like, they are naturally aligned necessarily to that quarter either. So the point I want to make is that there are some really important complexities in this situation. And now those few facts that I've articulated, I haven't seen those reported anywhere in the local press. I don't know whether you have, but I haven't.
Well, don't rely on the local press for nuance and complexities, Martin. they want, especially in this climate, they want hysteria and simplification, so that people just go with one runaway view that can advance a certain agenda. So just on that, well, maybe as I told you, there's one. I have a few graphics. I don't share my screen yet, but I'm going to bring one up.
Yeah. When you're ready, I can.
Just share my screen now.
Okay.
Please.
Hang on. Let's try that. There you go.
On current slide. Okay. All right. So let's have a read of this. This is the Declaration of State Sovereignty of Ukraine made in 1990. This declaration is like, it overrides all Ukrainian law. This is the peak law of Ukraine. And I've highlighted just one item in the declaration. It's a long declaration. This is one item. And if you're reading it, it says, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic solemnly declares its intention of becoming a permanently neutral state that does not participate in military blocs and adheres to three nuclear-free principles: to accept, to produce, and to purchase no nuclear weapons. But the important part in there is a permanently neutral state that does not participate in military blocs. That's actually Ukrainian law. And even though that was the way this is written, it's the SSR, that was reiterated a couple of times. And when Ukraine was accepted into the United Nations, it was accepted on the basis of this declaration. The whole world accepted this declaration of state sovereignty of Ukraine as the foundation of the world's relationship with Ukraine. So we are honoured to defend Ukraine if this declaration gets breached. Mm. The declaration is a declaration of permanent neutrality.
And that was done after the wall had come down and after Russia the USSR fell apart, right?
Yeah. This was the beginning of the process of establishing Ukraine as a separate state, right? So that's the only one I want to show for now.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to bear that in mind when you hear talk about Ukraine being in a special relationship with the EU.
Oh.
To join NATO, right? Now, even though being in a special relationship with the EU is not a military bloc, it's from the standpoint of Russia, it's something they would be concerned about, right? They wouldn't overreact though. In 2014, when the Maidan uprising in Ukraine was over this question of joining the EU, the EU was the one that had the ultimatum to Ukraine that says you can't join us and enter into any kind of economic pact with Russia. Russia offered Ukraine a deal where it could participate in both. So Russia was able to accept Ukraine participating in the EU in the form of the deal that was offered, but the EU wasn't, because that was a political ploy. A lot of this stuff is that, unfortunately, the smaller countries involved end up getting used as pawns, right? There are great power players at work, and you have to understand that those great power players drive the dynamics. So that was the undercurrent of what happened in 2014, but the different attitude of Russia and the EU is quite telling. But on the question of NATO, and all the discussion at the moment is about NATO, right? NATO refuses to say Ukraine will never be invited to join NATO. NATO instead says every country has a right to join NATO. Well, by its own supreme law, Ukraine should not even be thinking about it. But of course, there are strong political forces in Ukraine that want to do exactly that, right? And those forces, unfortunately, are fully backed by the United States and the United Kingdom, actually, which is the one of the more pernicious players in this. The United States, neoconservatives that push this idea, they have this idea of a Wolfowitz doctrine, what they call the Wolfowitz doctrine, after Paul Wolfowitz, one of the architects of the Iraq War. And they enunciated this doctrine in 1992, that post the fall of the Soviet Union, there would be no country ever allowed to rise to threaten, to be a rival economic or military power to the United States. Now, they've lost that in the case of China. That ship has sailed. But at the time, they were serious about it. And a lot of what set up, there was a foundation laid for this overall conflict in the 90s when America had that triumphalist attitude, right? And one of the things they did was send in their economic gurus and bankers and things, and so did the British. In fact, the British Mont Pelerin Society bragged about being an architect of this, to rip Russia to shreds economically with deregulation and privatization. That's what created the oligarchs, etc. It destroyed the living standards of the Russian people. They called it shock therapy, right? And of course, it was 10 years of misery, absolute misery for Russia. The population actually fell. For an industrial country, that is absolutely stunning. And that's when Putin came to power and drew a line in the sand and said, we're going to change this. And Russia has built up its strength ever since. But this was that economic assault on Russia coincided with America having this triumphalist attitude. And part of it was, okay, Russia's, you know, the Soviet Union's collapsed, but Russia's still Russia. It's a big country. It could be a big power. We either have to take it over or crush it. And that was what was driving the dynamic in the 1990s. They were interfering with elections. They had Boris. They had Boris Yeltsin on tap. The tap being vodka, unfortunately. And they were making sure Yeltsin got elected every time, instead of any kind of people, you know, that would actually put Russia's interests first. Yeltsin bombed the Russian Duma, you may remember, back in the early 90s there. That was a real great show of democracy. And that was all fully backed by the United States and the United Kingdom and those powers. So that laid the foundation for, like I said, this you know, finally Putin came to power and something had to be done. And what's the, what that was this building up of Russia's strength to the point where Russia could say no, and under Putin it has started to say no. And no, and the ultimate no is this, to this question of Ukraine joining NATO. Now, why would that be? Think about why that would be. Twice, two of the most famous military, two of the most famously ambitious military people in history invaded Russia and lost, but at great cost, right? And where did they come from? They didn't come from the south. They came from the west. They came from Europe. It was France and Germany, Napoleon and Hitler. And they came through Ukraine, right? And when people talk about Ukraine having its rights, which it absolutely does, there's another reality that just is a fact of the world. And that reality is the fact that there are these things called spheres of influence. America claims a sphere of influence over all of the North and South American continent. It's called the Monroe Doctrine. That means America would not tolerate interference in those countries. And that was displayed, but in a more urgent way, in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. So the Soviets put missiles in Cuba, and JFK was willing to take the world to war to get them out. And the Soviets backed down and they removed those missiles, right? And there's a real equivalence between what the Americans did to the Soviets then and what Russia is saying to Americans now in regard to Ukraine and this question of NATO. I do want people, Martin, to understand why now. Because this doesn't get reported in a lot of depth, there's been a huge amount of activity around Ukraine from the NATO side that is very, very alarming to Russia, just towards the end of last year, right? So I'll give you some examples here. On the 25th of November, the guided missile destroyer USS Arleigh Burke sailed into the Black Sea, continuing a deployment sustained over the recent months. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited a combat-ready battle group in Latvia, which is a NATO member on Russia's border, right, one of the Baltic states, on the eve of a foreign minister's meeting. A few days earlier in Berlin, Stoltenberg had campaigned for American B-61 nuclear bombs stored in Germany to be moved to a NATO member country closer to Russia. The Russians read the press too and understand that this is the kind of talk that's happening from the NATO side, right? We're going to move the most provocative, dangerous weapons in your path. When that sort of thing happens, right, the Russians say, okay, no, you know how we feel about this, so we're going to respond. And how did they respond? Well, they've responded by what the only fact that the media has been reporting in Australia, as if that was the cause of it. The Russian troops build up on the border, on Russia's border, is Russia's answer to these kinds of provocations, right? And I wrote a thing for our publication today. This is not before the Iraq invasion in the first Gulf War. America built up a massive force of troops in Saudi Arabia because that borders Iraq and it was about to invade there. But look where America's on the map, look where Saudi Arabia's on the map, and look where Iraq's on the map. Russia is putting a lot of troops in one position, but they're on Russia's border, inside Russia's territory, and they are responding to these kinds of provocations in relation to NATO. This year, 2022, NATO has 9 military exercises planned with Ukraine. So there'll be all sorts of NATO forces running around Ukraine this year in 1922 that will look like engaging in activity that will look like war battles. And they will say to Russia, Oh, trust us. This is just military exercises. But this crosses every line, short of actual war, that Russia has. And the last thing Russia is going to do is trust them. So these are NATO escalations against Russia, for which Russia has responded, right? Yet all we're getting in the press is the Russian side. Oh, there's going to be an invasion, there's going to be an invasion, there's going to be an invasion. And then, of course, then there comes a charade. So what's the latest charade? Australia put out the order that Australian officials and their families should leave Ukraine because America put out the order the day before. Oh, there's going to be an imminent invasion. The Europeans didn't put out that order. They're staying. Ukraine said, what are you doing? There's no imminent invasion. But it sure as hell plays well on Australian television because that's all you hear, that there's going to be an imminent Russian invasion. Whereas people on the ground know these things are charades. It's not actually true, right? And these add up to a lot of the reasons why with the escalation that's happening, the French and Germans aren't exactly playing along. Now, just for context, I have to mention one other thing that is a very important development in this overall picture. That is, in a sense, it's the main game. But all these distractions are potentially escalating the situation away from it. So before Christmas, Russia's deputy foreign minister met with his American counterpart to plan to prepare the way for a meeting after Christmas of Russia's foreign minister and Sergei Lavrov and America's Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. In the meeting before Christmas, the deputy foreign minister, Sergei Ryabkov, gave his American counterpart two documents, which were what I mentioned earlier, essentially two draft treaties that it's asking America to agree to, which put in writing what America promised Russia back in 1990, right? That is Russia's offer, peace offer. Accept that and we don't have a problem, right? Guarantee us our security and we don't have a problem. So that was the handover was then. In the meeting earlier this year between Lavrov and Blinken agreed that the United States would reply in writing soon, in the next week or two, to those concerns. Russia would have a reply in writing. Very interestingly, and this is a bit of a mystery as to why, Blinken requested but didn't demand that America would prefer if Russia kept those answers confidential. So that could be a good sign that maybe Biden, who has been around a long time, actually, this is where his age may work for good, frankly, because he's been in the Congress at the height of the Cold War, and he's been through this whole period of post-Cold War triumphalism and craziness. But he understands what the Cold War dangers could be, especially, you remember, Martin, there were two real periods of danger in the Cold War, the 60s around the Cuban Missile Crisis, and in the 80s, nuclear war was again a real danger in the 80s. So Biden may be being thoughtful here, right? Anyway, that was the offer. That was the message. We will reply in the next few weeks. That was delivered on the 20th. Now, that's the main game. What's in that reply? That's what Russia's hanging out for. What happens? The British, Liz Truss, that British foreign minister has just been here in Australia meeting with Maurice Payne and Peter Dutton. She puts out a claim that the British know that Russia's trying to install a puppet regime in Ukraine, and all hell breaks loose, and there's a huge rhetorical escalation over that. She had no evidence for the claim. She had hardly any details for the claim. The guy she identified as the Russian person, or the Russian pro-Russian person she identified as would lead this puppet government, is actually someone that Russia has sanctions on, right? None of the claims make sense, but the British are saying, we're the experts here, trust us, right? Well, I wouldn't trust them with a 10-foot barge pole. This is similar to the way as far as I'm concerned, this is similar to the role the British played in the Iraq invasion, where when push came to shove, instead of being the voice of caution for Bush and Cheney, Tony Blair literally fanned the flames. He made even worse claims than Bush and Cheney were prepared to make. He came up with fantasies like 45 minutes to attack, right? Britain, you know, Saddam could attack Britain in 45 minutes. And all this hysteria that the British came up with, you know, the sexed up dossier, all that kind of thing, was the British that claimed that Saddam was getting yellowcake uranium from Niger. All that was then able to be used by the Americans, by the Bush-Cheney regime, to get their to promote their war. Right, I see the British playing a similar role here. They've got. I've been in Britain actually at a time when in you know 2015, 2016, when the tensions with Russia were high. Right, and the relationship. You know, this is like a long-standing enmity between the British and the Russians, and it's full on. And so there are people in Britain that are just not going to tolerate a resolution of this in a way that they don't approve of, right? And there are mad snakes in Britain, in the United States, neocons. There's an outfit called the Henry Jackson Society in the United Kingdom, which is the worst neocon outfit in the world. They are absolutely extremists. They claim the right to invade any country they like to impose their democracy, their idea of democracy, right? These people, the Henry Jackson Society is aggressively Russophobic and is at the forefront of attacking Russia all the time and pumping out propaganda against Russia. And so, yeah, just at this moment where everything should have calmed down and you have a breathing space while America writes this reply to the Russians on this most important of matters, you get this intervention, and now we've got this flashpoint where it's capable of getting out of control before that reply is written. And because remember, when you talk about countries like Britain, the United States, it's not everyone's on, you know, we talk about not all Europe's on the same page. Not everyone in those countries is on the same page. You have the foreign policy establishment in Washington is called the Blob, and there's all kinds of factions there, et cetera. Some don't want this at all. I shared a video with you about that earlier. You saw that person. Some will blow up the world to get their utopian fantasy of what they think, you know, a US-UK dominated unipolar world. And so those factions are capable of bringing their power to bear in these vulnerable times and literally blowing it up, right? And that's what is on our plate this week and why it's so dangerous.
Right. Well, very interesting comments in the chat too. I put a few up, but there's a lot that I haven't been able to. But there's a couple of sort of threads I want to sort of unpick a little bit. A few people were asking about gas. To what extent is gas just a sort of a little bit on the side, or is it a fundamental issue? Because of course the story is that there's a gas pipeline which effectively allows Russia to sell gas into Europe. There's another one that's just been commissioned, although Germany hasn't yet certified it, so it's not actually open. And of course a lot of Western Europe now relies on gas from Russia. And interestingly, I read somewhere when I was doing some research for this that the US has basically promised that if necessary, they'll supply liquid gas to Europe if Russia turns the pipe off.
Yep. let me add a caveat. I know quite a bit. I don't claim to be a deep expert. I tend to know more about events as they're happening, as I explained to you. The last time things were so tense with Russia was 2014, and at the time, you know, I was all over it. Our organisation, I mean, we blanketed Canberra with a million, well, it wouldn't have been a million, there's not a million in Canberra, like 100,000 copies of our newspaper explaining what was really going on behind the coup in Ukraine. But since then, I've spent all my time analysing what's happening with China, right? So I'm aware of these issues. So I'll offer certain opinions. I think they're well founded. But if you want more authoritative stuff from what we know, it's not going to come exactly off the top of my head. You can read plenty of material on our website about this. But I will say this about the gas. So the thing with the gas is more to do with if, because Russia has lots of gas and is definitely wants to sell it to Europe, and Europe needs it. And so the real issue there is the Americans and the British look at that and go, oh, no, this is the basis of a cooperative relationship between Europe and Russia, right? And that's where the gas becomes a factor, not in and of itself. It's because of that possibility. So then they come up with these, you know, there's all these beat-ups about, you know, the big bad Putin and you're dependent on Russia, et cetera. You've got to break that. Oh, we'll ship you gas from the United States, right, as if. I mean, look at global supply chains. Why would you, especially in today's environment, why would you rely on a shipping supply chain for your gas in this current pandemic crisis? And everything else has happened to supply chains, when you can get it on in a pipe, and Russia's got a second pipe there to provide as well, and you'll never run out, right? Because this is Europe; it gets cold. You got to have your gas, right? There's no substitute for it, and very much the major issue there.
Right, but the point is, Robbie, that fuel prices in Europe have gone sky high already, right? If you look at the cost of energy, I think in the UK, some households, as from next March, will be putting 1/7 of their total income just to pay for fuel for heating houses, right, in the UK, because of the very high price of gas and things like that, right? And we know that in other parts of Europe it's the same. So it's a big deal in those countries, right? And it's a bit mystifying to me as to why Germany hasn't certified the pipeline, which appears to be complete and ready to turn on, and I'm not sure what games are going on there. I don't know enough about it. But it does seem to me that this energy conundrum is part of the story. And, of course, if you stand back, you know, what people are suggesting is that Putin is doing everything he can to, you know, just create mayhem, you know, and they talk about cyber and they talk about energy and, you know, et cetera, right? Forgetting, of course, that there are people on the other side probably doing quite similar things and, you know, there's a lot of disruption and misinformation around wherever you look. But it seems to me that the energy story is a very important part of the puzzle, because it tells you something about what the power plays really are across the region.
Yeah, for sure. The Germans, you know, they're a country that has, since World War II, has relied on the United States and NATO for its security, but they also are right in the firing line in Europe. And they're not dumb, and they recognise that these tensions can run away. So there must have been some go-ahead from them to build, I think it's, I forget the name of the, I was remembering the name of the pipeline, but whatever it is, there must have been some deal with them to supply this. But the pressure has come on them in a very big way, right? Not from Russia, but from the other side. Now, look, I'll state for the record, I don't believe any of the guff, any of the narrative about, oh, Putin creating mayhem. You know, look, let's can we make a comparison between Putin and Xi and Biden and, say, Morrison?
Interesting list.
I'm looking at Morrison. He's flat out keeping on top of everything in his own country. He's flat out trying to juggle things in such a way that he stays in power and maintains some kind of modicum of popularity, and he's not doing a very good job at all. It is too hard, right? Keeping his own country happy is too hard. Biden is having exactly the same problem in the United States. He cannot solve all the problems, the domestic problems that are presented to him in the United States, right? Yet we hear media narratives that there are countries in the world where the leaders of those countries who have just as big a countries and just as big a domestic problems, they just get to sit there like on a big screen TV video game with joysticks, twiddling their joysticks to creating mayhem in the West. That's how they get their jollies. No, sorry, they have busy day jobs. And when you're the leader, it's not just a day job, it's a night job as well, right? Every leader is flat out looking out, trying to solve the domestic problems that, that they're presented with, every single one. And what they hope upon hope against hope is that in terms of international affairs, right, they can have some kind of, you know, peaceful deal making, etc., that makes that job easier, right? Because I'll provide the, you know, the Germans, like, let's get this reliable source of gas, right? That solves a domestic problem. But then we just have this narrative that, oh, you know, so a Putin type is just there to cause problems for everyone. It's just rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. He's a human being. He's a normal person. He's just someone that won't take our crap anymore. That's what he is. He's drawn a line in the sand. They're leaders of big, old, powerful countries, and China just as much, if not more so. So then that's why you've got to look at, in our so-called democratic countries, when you have these economic forces, right? Because when America makes that concession to or pledge to the Germans, right, there's oil companies and gas companies in the United States and the United Kingdom, they're going to cop, you know, profit from that, right? So there's that benefit. But the larger, and I reckon that's secondary, the larger one, though, is these people are geopoliticians, right? What I and my organisation, Martin, regard geopolitics as evil. Geopolitics you could think of as the idea, if in a certain way, think of it as just this idea of divide and conquer, right? This was what the British have been like for centuries. There's a European nickname for the British Empire, called, the Europeans call it perfidious Albion. You can't trust it, because for centuries, Britain, over there on its island, away from the rest of Europe, would look at the powers of Europe, and whichever was the larger power, Britain would side with the lesser power. Not because they were right and the other one was wrong or whatever, just because it was a larger power, so it could balance that power. That's what geopolitics is, balance of power politics, right? And you've got academicians in influential decision-making places in government who think of the world that way. They do not automatically think that Russia and China is evil. They just think, oh, they're more powerful. We have to do something about that. Why? Become more powerful yourself. Concentrate on your economy and build it up, right? And stop worrying about them. Let them get on with building up their economies. Of course they're going to become more powerful, but they don't. Oh, no, we've got to play these games. We've got to play these imperial games, right, like the great game over Afghanistan and subcontinent for all those years. We must do that. We must balance that power. And how do you do that? Well, you've got to have a war. And how do you have a war? Well, you've got to demonize the other side. And that's the kind of thinking that comes into this. So they can't just sit back and look at a German-Russian gas pipeline deal. Foreign interference is something that's completely on the nose nowadays. But and Russia and China are the ones that are accused of it, right? But the Americans and Brits are the masters of it, and they would be interfering like crazy in Germany to build up groups to try and derail those kinds of deals, right, and stymie them, et cetera. What's very interesting, I'll tell you a good, marker of how bad this danger is right now, though, is that the new coalition in charge in Germany includes the Green Party, and the Green Party is the most Russophobic, anti-Russian party in Germany, extremely Russophobic, yet that coalition with the Green Party in it has refused to participate in this US-UK NATO hysteria against Russia. And they refused to let the British fly their weapons. The British flew, they called it lethal aid, flew their weapons into Ukraine. The Germans, this current German government, refused to let them do this because they don't want any part of it. And for doing that, they're gonna paint a target on their back. There will be repercussions inside Germany, I suspect.
Right. And, with all of these things, and I think the main message coming out of the conversation so far is, you know, there are bunches of cross currents that really you got to get to understand, rather than just taking that headline position, you know, understand where that position is coming from and why it's being said, but actually it's a deflection, it's a distraction, it's a specific strategy for a specific purpose, right? Reality is a lot more complicated, firstly, but and secondly, it's got to be more balanced than you know, Russia bad, China bad, US good, right? Which is, you know, that polarization is, and I see that pretty much everywhere when I look around, that it's almost, you got to pick a side, right? Because, yeah, well, one's on the side of evil and one's on the side of good, right? The truth of the matter is that actually they're both using the same sorts of tools, they're both using the same sorts of disinformation. You know, it is the rules of the game. But the rules of the game also is to try and appear to be holier than thou, so that effectively you can then say, no, the other guys are evil, right? That's because that's what you want. You want to demonize them.
Well, people would accuse me of picking a side. I'm sure there's been comments in the chat about that, you know, and that's the side of Russia. That's the side of Russia and China. Well, I'm an Australian patriot. I'm not on the side of Russia and China, but there's a reason I'm very outspoken about this, because as an Australian patriot, I am extremely disgusted with the role my country has played in the last 20 years in actions that Russia and China are not guilty of. They didn't invade Iraq on a lie and kill a million people. They didn't then turn around and repeat that in Libya and actually at the UN Security Council lie to the Russians by saying we just want a no-fly zone over Libya to protect the people, this group in Benghazi from Gaddafi. That's all it's for. That's what Obama said in the UN Security Council in order to get Russia to not use its veto for that intervention. Russia accepted that. They put up the no-fly zone. Next thing, it became regime change, and it ended in Libya being turned into one of the most absolutely horrific failed states in history. It went from the richest country in Africa to now a basket case and a haven of terrorism. That's where ISIS and Al Qaeda go to holiday, basically. Slavery, slave trading is back, etc. The Americans and the British did that, not the Russians. Then they turned around to do the same thing in Syria, and by that time, Putin said no. So Putin intervened in Syria as well because he was invited to by the lawful government, not because he invaded from the outside like the Americans have. The Americans are now in Syria burning wheat fields to force the Syrians into submission, bombing dams, and as Donald Trump openly bragged, stealing the oil. Syria's oil, oh, we're taking it. Right? They haven't done that. They've stayed inside their own countries trying to take care of their own issues, but they have issues on their border that they have firm views on that they've expressed to the world, but they're just on their border, right? They are security matters and strategic interests to them. We're the ones that go out way outside of anything to do with our national interests and go around and commit these horrific acts around the world. That's why I sound like I'm on the side of Russia and China. I'm on the side of morality and right, and I want our country to start behaving right in the world stage. What our country has done is gone along with this mantra, which is an evil doctrine that the Americans and the British and us have been pumping out there for the last 10 years or so, and it's called the rules-based order. And we attack Russia and China for not abiding by the rules-based international order. But that term does not refer to international law, Mark. International law is what is approved at the UN. It's the UN Charter and the things associated with it. That's international law. The rules-based order is our rules-based order. We make it up as we go along. And I'll give you a clear example of it in the South China Sea. The United States sends these aircraft carrier groups through the South China Sea for freedom of navigation. I hope everyone here has watched the really hilarious ABC Utopia clip where the person from the agency is talking to the generals and saying, you know, why are we trying to protect our trade routes with China from China? Why is China a threat to our trade routes with China? That's what goes through the South China Sea. But America saying, nope, we're flying these aircraft carrier groups with each, which of these are awesome formations of ships that have enough firepower to blow up the world, right? Because we're protecting the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. You know, China's accused of breaking the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea with its claims over the islands, even though Taiwan and Vietnam and, you know, all those countries, they all have similar claims, their own claims. The United States is not even a signatory to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, yet it claims to be in there enforcing the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea is international law. The US doesn't think it applies to it, right? But ridiculously, farcically, it's the enforcer of it. That's what I mean by the rules-based order. And these countries, they're not dumb, gullible Australians getting drip-fed lies from their media. The people running those countries are as smart as anyone in our countries. They know it's garbage and they're just not going to take it anymore. And that's why you might think our viewers might think, some of them might think I look biased. No, I've been through enough, mate. And I've had it too. The world doesn't have to be this way. The world can get on much better, but we've got to get this evil geopolitics balance of power thinking out of it and actually say, work out, look, how can we cooperate or not? What do we have in common? We have this thing called the common aims of mankind. That's what we should look for, common ground all the time, right? Where not a doctrine that says we have to be on top of the pile and cannot ever have a rival to us. Because if we spend our lives pursuing that doctrine, it's going to end in tears. And, you know, the Russia flashpoint and the China flashpoint over Taiwan are the two most obvious things that could end the world in tears.
Well, is it too of a long bow to say, actually, you know, the neoliberal philosophy that driving pretty much everything is driving this too, in a way? It's part of that same sort of doctrine, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's I don't think it's long, but I think it's the driver. Because, see, why do you want to dominate the world? you're an empire, right? Empires want to dominate the world because the imperial economic model is looting. It's based on looting. Neoliberalism is not a long-term economic theory, Martin. It's already have, you know, we've experienced it for 40 years in Australia. Look where it's got us. We cannot manufacture for ourselves. We cannot equip our hospitals with enough staff, right? We call ourselves the richest country in the world, and all we have to show for it is a mountain of debt, right? Massive household debt, etc. That's what neoliberal, we don't invest anymore. We could be making this country so productive. We could be, developing the inland, you know, taking the pressure off the cities, etc. But you can't do that because we have a neoliberalism that said the government cannot have a role in the economy. It's got to be just the private sector. The private sector is dominated by big players when it's the law of the jungle in the private sector, and it's not the field mouse who makes the decision. It's the lion, right? And he says, you know, the banks, we just want maximum profits, and we're going to do this and this for maximum profits. And it's short-termism, and it never lasts very long, right? But when it comes to things like the banks, just like politicians, by the time there's repercussions, the bank executives who made those decisions are not there, and other bank executives are left to handle it. They own the governments. The governments bail them out, and they think they can do it again. But meanwhile, the overall curvature, the overall wealth of the economy is getting smashed. That's what neoliberalism does, right? And globally, it's the same thing. So you reach out, you spread out globally. We are, if you take stock of what's happened in this two decades, or especially the decade and a half from around just before 2008, we are in the collapse phase of this neoliberal empire. Thatcherism, Reaganomics, Rogernomics in New Zealand, what Keating did in Australia, dismantled economies all over the world, right? The European Union structure has done the same thing to Europe. Yeah, there's basic things that, survive, held together by you know, chewing gum and Band-Aids, right? But it's not the functional economy that it could be and that it used to be. This is a collapse phase. Have the governments of the world rallied since 2008 to say, okay, well, let's take away these powers from the banks, let's invest in the real economy instead? No. They just invented all this money to keep the banks propped up. Well, all of them except one, and that one's supposedly the most evil one in the world. The one that didn't do that, that used its credit powers to actually create a productive powerhouse, make a manufacturing boom, built 36,000 kilometres of high-speed railway, lifted 800 million people out of poverty who now have better lives. That's the definition of evil in this world now. Yet the economy is run by bullfeds like Boris Johnson, who parties like freaking Nero while his city is in lockdown because he doesn't give a rat's, right? When this Russia crisis pops up, he's there because he's the goody. Oh, Boris must be the goody. No, he's a slovenly toad who'll march his country into World War III. Too stupid or too uncaring to give us stuff, right? And that's what our this is the great democracy that we're trying to impose around the world. Hey, I've got a message for you. The rest of the world's saying no thanks. And another reality check, Martin, while I'm on one of my long runs. Sorry, Cookie. This whole conflict with Russia, China, what we're talking about, it's Russia and China, right? And the conflicting powers are Australia, United States, United Kingdom, a bit of Canada sometimes when Trudeau can be bothered, and a few European countries. The majority of the world is not with us. There's a much bigger world out there, and they've said, sorry, guys, you're either on your own or we're against you. We are so far out in the limb and isolated, with our heads up our ass, we can't see it because we're just relying on this Anglosphere-centric media, etc. That's the world in which we live. But we've all drunk the neoliberal Kool-Aid, right? So we're in this collapse phase. And what do elites do when their system is collapsing? Well, look, just look at history. The history of the world is fundamental economic collapses are always accompanied by major wars. Sometimes it's just it's never that much of an organic process, but sometimes it's chaotic and it gets out of control. But most of the time, what's actually happening is the elites are trying to maintain power, and war is a means of maintaining power, right? War is a means of just throwing over the chessboard, but in a way that you can maintain power under certain circumstances. But we can't afford that now. It's not the 1930s. It's not the 1910s. Right, the consequences are too grave, and that's where if you believed in peace and wanted a functional economy, you cannot look at China and buy into the garbage. They are incredibly damn successful, and they're reaching out. They've invited the whole world to participate with them. They're not trying to keep it to themselves. America could be in there with the Belt and Road projects with China. It could be if all these things it claims about, it could be participating in it and it being a balancing influence and policing it if it will. No, no, can't do that, right? Oh, no, we've got to stick to our system. We don't want a system where actually governments can be competent and achieve outcomes. Oh, no, because that would just blow up in the face of our neoliberal doctrine. So, they won't do that and they're prepared to strike this sort of conflict instead. But the issue is neoliberalism. Our neoliberalism has put Wall Street and the City of London in charge of the Anglo-speaking world. They run us. You and I have, when we're not, you know, luckily this is a rare subject, Martin. Most of the time we're having much, much more productive conversations about the banks. And what do we know about the banks? What do we know about that, right? They are virtually untouchable. Hey, as an aside, We have an article in our magazine today about AFCA, the Australian Financial Complaints Authority. This thing is a rigged game. Everything that this is the body that's supposed to be the honest broker and umpire. You know, if you've had a bad experience with the banks, it's going to umpire it. And the whole thing is rigged in favour of the banks. It is jaw-dropping. It's an excellent article. People should call in and get a copy, right? That's just an example of we've seen that repeated time and time and time again. That's the world that was created with this neoliberalism, and it's collapsing around our ears. And those elites who should be, you know, running away and hanging their heads in shame, them and the media are instead trying to create a massive destruction of wars. And the people need to see through it.
Yeah, well, we probably will come back and have a more detailed conversation about Africa, because I also have some war stories about that. It is completely rigged. It is not a fit-for-purpose entity at all. It's just another paping over the cracks. But if I come back a little bit, and specifically we're talking about the dynamics of Russia and the West and those sorts of things, right? When the economy is under pressure, as it currently is now, and when effectively politicians are out of ideas, sometimes they like to create, misdirection. Look over there rather than over there, right? And I guess one of the questions in the chat, and it's one of the questions that I have, is to what extent is the current cycle of engagement, specifically with China and Russia, really about misdirection? In other words, they're going to get us to focus on, the risk of war and all of those things, and rather than actually the real issues that are confronting real Australians and, real people in other countries around the world. Is it misdirection or what is it?
Look, misdirection is an issue that it's a ploy that can be used. But I don't think so. This is actually long-term. This is a long-term trajectory that's coming to a head. In late 2015 and then in increasingly 2016, 2017, and then definitely late 2017 and early 2018, the United States, which has this procedure which is in its own way somewhat transparent, where they put out their national security doctrines and they put them in writing. But before that, there's a lead-up process where there's a fair amount of discussion about it, et cetera. And if you remember from, 2011 onwards, and then especially Charlie Hebdo, the French wave of terrorist attacks started in 2013, I believe. So for the middle of the 2010s, we were grappling with this real horror of terrorism. That's what was dominating the news. Which, in fact, as an aside, even in the 2016 election, WikiLeaks quoted people like Biden admitting America funded ISIS, right? They were happy to deploy these monsters, but nevertheless, that's what the focus was, and they did that clandestinely, openly. It was like, okay, terrorism is the great threat, and the war on terror had been the dominant theme for 15 years after 9/11. In 2015, that changed because the rhetoric suddenly became our greatest adversaries are Russia and China. And by late 2017, that was enshrined in America's national security, I forget the term, I'm going to call it doctrine, right? Russia and China are the enemy. That was enshrined. And they called them a greater threat to the United States than ISIS terrorism. I mean, these are countries that had actually helped the United States fight terrorism. And suddenly, these are academic strategist wankers in Washington are putting together these security doctrines that are just, poking Russia and China in the eye. Oh, they're the greatest threat. Why? Well, just simply because of the rise of China, for one, right? It was kicking America's butt all over the place, not through intention, right? It's not responsible for America's self-destruction, but that's what was going on. And so those national security doctrines reveal long-term strategic planning. You had parallel stuff happening in the United Kingdom at the same time. That ASPE reference that you had earlier, if you go back through ASPE's website, don't get me started on ASPE, they They are a think tank of lies and wars that must be shut down. This is an absolute propaganda outfit in Australia. It's funded by the US State Department. Like, it's funded by the Australian government, mostly the Defence Department, but it has all these foreign funders. And the biggest one of those is US State Department, but the British, the Dutch and the Japanese government funded, and then all these private weapons manufacturers like Lockheed Martin also funded. And it just gives its funders what it wants, and it pumps out all these lies on their behalf that get reported all around the world. Oh, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute says this. You go back far enough in its website, it will be reflecting the same thing at the same time, because that's its job, right, to make sure Australia follows, toes the line with this shift in strategic doctrine. For us, the main game is China. You know, for people in Europe like the Brits, that's why Russia, in Britain, Russia is a bigger issue than China, because these two together have been identified as the strategic threats. And of course, all it's served to do, if you are going to play, if this is how you think the world works and you're going to play this game, your stupidity has already lost the game, because all you have that served to do is force Russia and China together. And you're not Russia and China together equals unbeatable. That's it, right? China has about 100 nuclear weapons. It might expand that to 300, compared to America and Russia's 6,000, I think, something like that, right? China has enough to defend itself, but it's got the most awesome manufacturing capacity in the world. Russia's got all the resources it could ever want, right? And together, I mean, they're the two countries together that could bring down the US dollar, and then that is the end of the empire, right? And that's all you're served to do there. So, but, you know, it's actual stupidity, but this is the long-term trajectory. Now, some people, you know, I can't name them, but some of these utopian strategists who come up with this, some of them actually harbour a fantasy that when push comes to shove, because nuclear war is so unthinkable, and America does have, at least on paper, superior military firepower, when push comes to shove, Russia and China will back down to avoid the unthinkable. That is a total misreading of the situation. They won't. In fact, in a minute, I want to go through some graphics. And then others are even dumber. They think a limited nuclear war is winnable and survivable, and that it will stay limited. That is, there are people in Australia who've said that, and there are people today in America. There's a Roger Wicker is a sitting US congressman that just before Christmas, when he was talking about this Russian danger, he said, we reserve the right, the right to first strike nuclear attack over Ukraine. That's what he said the other day. That it's even on their lips is just absolutely shocking. Right, go watch Dr. Strangelove. That's the kind of mentality that is bubbled to the surface in the United States at the moment, because it has a long history with a lot of these different threads contributing to it. So I think we're way beyond sort of pacifying ourselves by saying, oh, this is just temporary misdirection. No, it's not. Pay attention to that American answer to Russia's demands. That's the main game. And how the Russians respond to that. That's the main game, because Russia is serious. Now, even though you might have some more stuff to ask me, Martin, at this point, I just wanted to show these other graphics, because they do illustrate how serious Russia is.
Sure.
Right, so that no one's under any delusion. So you can
show you the screen. I'm switching across now. There you go.
Share the screen.
Yep. You're up.
All right. So this graphic speaks for itself, really, but it doesn't get talked about enough. There's when Russia was not invited to the 75th anniversary of the VE Day celebrations in 2015, Russia was not invited. It was the ultimate insult, because look at that brown line at the top. That brown line broke the Nazi war machine, and it cost, they put that figure as 24 million. It could be as high as 32 million. It cost 32 million Soviet deaths to break the Nazi war machine. That's the truth of World War II. The Americans had played a fantastic role. Most every country contributed, like, you know, all the stuff we grew up with is all true, you know. I mean, my grandfather was a boy in the Blitz in London, and he was proud of his big brothers who fought in the war and both died in the war, and all that was true. But America and Britain and Australia don't even feature on this, right? This is the death toll, the real death toll of World War II, and the Soviet Union bore the brunt of it. They were our ally in World War II. Very, very important. They were our ally. So now, you know, that gave them a view of Nazis, Martin. That solidified in the Russian mind, you know, what they thought about Nazis. And where did those Nazis come from? Well, they came from Germany via Ukraine. So let me introduce you to this character. His name is Stepan Bandera. Now, Stepan Bandera was the chief Nazi collaborator in Ukraine in World War II. He led an alliance called the Organization of Ukrainian Nationals, the OUN. I just quickly took these images from Wikipedia, but you can see. So what the text there is, because you can't read it. Everyone can recognize Heil Hitler, but then glory to Hitler, below it, glory to Bandera, right? So he was an out-and-out Nazi, Stepan Bandera. And, you know, of course, that's one of the issues with Ukraine. You have a very pro-Russian side of Ukraine and Russian-speaking, and you have a very pro-Western side of Ukraine. The pro-Russian side, I mean, there's more Orthodox Christianity there. The Western side is more Catholic Christianity, etc. And among the Western side, there was a big, big Nazi element that still exists to this day. And the evidence of that is this event. This was 2014. This was the Maidan in Kiev where the uprising was held. And this is what Russia was trying to tell the world. That these protesters who were using the European Union as an issue, look who they're adulating, right? This is not hidden at the Maidan. This was very, very prominent. There was a massive right-wing extremist component, not all of it, but the component of right-wing extremism and neo-Nazism in that Maidan uprising was huge. And that's where the violence came from, that component. And there were photos. People like John McCain and the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, were posing with these out-and-out Nazis, right? They were happy to use them to overthrow the Ukrainian government, which was friendly to Russia. That's what Russia knows about what it's dealing with in Ukraine. And then this is the one that everyone should take seriously because it's quite chilling. So, just for everyone's benefit, I'll read the quote. Dmitry Yarosh, 17th of July 2013, just a year before the Maidan uprising, he said, "The times are coming when we will not only be talking and conducting various propaganda actions about the national revolution, but the times are coming that will forge history and fix the footprint of our people in the existence of the Ukrainian nation. We must show not only in words but with our deeds that the Bandera cause is not yesterday, but it is the present and the future. The times are approaching that we may have been only dreaming about for these 20 years." And that person, in November, just before Christmas last year, was appointed the advisor to the Commander-in-Chief of the Ukrainian Armed Forces. So what you've got is this really hardcore element that is very, very dominant in Ukraine politics, in the Ukraine military, in the Ukraine security forces, in the Ukraine police forces, and we would never tolerate them in Australia. Never, right? But people like Kimberly Kitching, my old friend, who attacked me in a parliamentary hearing last year and lied that I was anti-Semitic, which is it's absolutely untrue. They champion this element in Ukraine. They champion what was done to Ukraine in 2014 because there's so much, they serve the Anglo-American agenda and they're prepared to use anybody. But the Russians who had that experience, who are avowed anti-Nazis, right? They fought a war of annihilation against them in World War II. They know that that element is being used again in Ukraine. It becomes a terrible factor in the conflict, right? It breeds all sorts of violence, etc. That's what they know. It's totally ignored by the West, right? But if you really want to understand what the Russian thinking is on this and why they're playing hardball and aren't going to tolerate this, that's a good insight for you, right? And as that person on that video, I sent Martin a video that was actually on Sky News by a former advisor to the US State Department, James Carden, who was interviewed on Sky News here on Sunday. And he just made the simple point, this can all be resolved if we take Russia's security concerns seriously. But we cannot resolve it if we say, no, we're going to ignore those concerns. We're going to ignore this Nazi element. We're going to just see the world entirely our way. If we want to take that attitude, we will end up talking ourselves into a war.
Yeah, Robbie, absolutely. And, I think that's why we felt it was important to have this conversation tonight, because, as you say, there are decisions and information over the next few days that will actually mark people's cards going ahead. But I guess there's another angle to that, and that's also the question of economic fallout, right? So, we've already seen the markets since January pretty wobbly. One of the things that have actually created that wobbliness has been this uncertainty around Ukraine and Russia. And as I mentioned, we've got gas prices going up. But clearly there's an economic potential fallout as well as a geopolitical and military fallout from all of this. And I think that perhaps that hasn't been explained to people either. And I'm very concerned that what we're doing is effectively just barreling towards a particular outcome without thinking about these broader contexts and about the outfall, economically speaking, as well.
I've stopped being surprised by how little the decision makers think of all the factors involved, Martin. of course this is an issue. The world is actually economically right on the edge. The inflation question in the United States isn't going away.
Nope.
I think the latest figures I saw is world debt has grown 35%, so now it's at a record of 350% to GDP to GDP. It's 350% of GDP, right, which is an all-time record.
Yep.
That's globally. That's all around the world. And, of course, that's shared unevenly between countries. And, the supply chain breakdown in a pandemic has been disruptive enough. Why would you want a war? I mean, seriously, why would you want a war? Why would you want to risk that? I mean, we should have a situation. Hopefully, hand on heart, hopefully it doesn't take a war to make us wise up and see that we need to make more of our own stuff here and supply ourselves. Of course, we should have been doing that all along. And it doesn't need that. That's a decision we can make any time. Maybe a war will force that on us, but there'll be a lot of dysfunction in the meantime. We are not prepared for that at all, right? We haven't adapted to this situation at all. It's been ridiculous how easily things have fallen over in this disruption of the pandemic. A war would be infinitely worse than that. The markets are a bubble anyway. I think Jeremy Grantham, the American guru, didn't he call it a meta bubble or something? There's never been a bubble in all these six classes at one time before. Yep. and that's what we're in. That's all poised to go up in flames. This, you know, you push this much further. Anything like this could be easily be that. But you've got this delusion among the decision makers that, you know, it's kind of like the delusion, you know, where, you know, in wars in Europe, you know, like World War II and before, where the wars are between ostensibly Christian countries and they all think God's on their side. Because God's on their side, they can't lose. It's that kind of delusion, right? The sense of superiority, you know, our system must be superior. Therefore, we have to win. We have to beat these Russians because they grow up reading fantasy books or something. You know, that kind of thinking is capable of just blundering into something that's that will have very, very bad consequences for everybody. I mean, it's, you know, look, here's one way to think about it. You know, I think I've stated the obvious there. So did you somewhat. We've stated the obvious. Of course, this is going to be disastrous. That doesn't affect the question necessarily of control that I talked about earlier, because those economic elite powers that are in control now, that oligarchy, if you will, you know, they've got all these laws in place. They can maintain their control, justified by wars. But let's call it the opportunity cost. Look at the other side. What could the world be if we stepped away from the brink? What could the world be if we said, oh, hang on, let's just cooperate? What could the world be if the Americans said, well, you know, okay, there's no evidence that, we've been banging on about this Russia-China threat forever. There's no evidence of it. You know, the people that tell us this are the same people that have lied us into all these conflicts in the past. Let's just stop believing them. Let's not define ourselves as having, by this Wolfowitz doctrine, where we've got to be the top dog at all costs, because all costs aren't worth it. You can have a multipolar world, right, where we're respected, but we have to respect other powers, et cetera, and other spheres of influence and those sort of things. And the minute there's – and if you give that enough time to set, then, you know, there's more trust that builds up in the system. But the cooperation that can come with that is of immense benefit. You know, there's a train line that's just opened in Vietnam, built by the Chinese. One's just opened in Laos, built by the Chinese. These are high-speed trains, right? And what does it do? Good infrastructure transforms your daily lives. It transforms your productive capacity. I have to indulge in a local issue here in Melbourne, because people, when I spent a couple of weeks in Queensland over Christmas for my holiday, everyone I met was bagging Dan Andrews. And I said, well, what are you bagging him for? You don't live under him. I do. But, you know, there's a certain media obsession with Dan Andrews because of the lockdowns of that. And based on what the talk about Dan Andrews, I can't believe that someone like him is even elected. But I think Dan Andrews, when you live here in Melbourne, you know why. I remember why Dan Andrews got elected, and it's an example of the importance of infrastructure, because infrastructure can change lives. Dan Andrews got elected in 2014, I think, because on a platform where he said he would get rid of the level crossings and have overpasses for the trains so the traffic could flow. And he did. He promised 19. I think he delivered 25. And if you're in an area where that was done, your daily life was completely different. I mean, I have been, the one closest to me has both the domestic trains on it. And, you know, if you're in a level crossing area, you know the worst case scenario with that, right? It's when two trains come, not at the same time, but far enough apart that they won't raise the gates, right? And so you can be stuck there for, you know, 5 minutes or something. It's a pain. But in my line, there's also a freight train that goes out to Bendigo. And if you're there when the three of those happen, forget about it. You can be there for 15 minutes. And if you're in a hurry, that's hell on earth. That's all getting changed. That's that right now, that's being worked on. It's going to be built. that when you have infrastructure that changes your daily life, improves it, raises your productivity, you remember that, right? And Dan Andrews got credit for that. That's why I got re-elected in 2019. This is not an ad for Dan Andrews. It's an illustration of the importance of infrastructure. But I told people that's why he actually got that support and got elected. That's just the reality. And that can happen all around the world, right? America's got huge infrastructure needs. Focus on it. Cooperate. There's a lot of know-how in China now. Cooperate on it. A lot of know-how in Australia as well, but we're losing it. It's all getting old and dying. We need to tap it while it's alive and get back to building infrastructure, big infrastructure projects here, right? Barnaby Joyce, before the 2019 election, when he was a backbencher, spent the whole time campaigning for the Bradfield scheme to get water in North Queensland diverted inland. Since he's been Deputy Prime Minister, he hasn't said a boo about it because they use it as a tease for the electorate. But it could be built. It could transform. It could be transformative for agriculture in the inland, you know. But that's that. If the world could focus on that, and not these war threats, which are actually sideshows from what we should be doing, even though they're very, very serious dangers, then the whole world could be a much, much, much better place. All right, that's the opportunity cost to what we're doing.
Absolutely. Well, that's the whole point. And, you know, one of the reasons to have this conversation is it's important for people to make their own decisions. To make good decisions, you need to have a different set of perspectives. Turn the Rubik's Cube and just see what you get by way of different pictures and alternatives, right, rather than just taking the mainstream view. But there was one other question in the chat before we close off. You know, the Russian issue and NATO is a long, long way from Australia. So why is Australia so engaged in this and so in, you know, there? You know, is there some logic? Is it because it's the US? You know, why Australia?
This is one of my favourite topics. Look, there's an entity that we're being run by, in fact, that is way above the authority power of our government, and this is at a practical level. It's called Five Eyes. A while ago, last year or the year before, John Adams found this great YouTube show. It was on YouTube. It's now on Netflix. It's called True Believers. It was a 1980s ABC show, and it was about the Chifley government. And it's a dramatized show. When Chifley was asked by the British to establish a permanent intelligence organisation, and Chifley said, absolutely not. I don't want a police state in Australia. There's the military had their own intelligence function, etc. But MI5 had requested Australia start an intelligence agency. Chifley wouldn't do it. They set up a scam, basically, to sort of force it on the Chifley government. It's called the Lapstone Experiment at the Lapstone Hotel in the Blue Mountains. And it's worth telling the story. But this was an experiment. There was a big conference and Russians were going to be at this conference. And they said, let us put bugs in their listening devices because we will prove that they are spying on and plotting against us. These Russians are spying on and plotting against Australians. So they did that. And when they checked the bugs, there was nothing there. There was no evidence. And how did they respond to that? They said, oh, see, it proves we must have better intelligence to be able to detect them. That's why we need this organization. And then it was set up. Some of the early people involved were people we've identified, actual openly pro-Nazis in the 1930s. Anyway, that was the birth of ASIO. ASIO entered into this agreement, this intelligence sharing agreement with the United States and the United Kingdom, Yakuza, went by other names, that evolved in now what we call Five Eyes. And so what you have is this intelligence sharing relationship where we're in the club, Canada, New Zealand, United States, United Kingdom, Australia. We're all in this club. And those intelligence agencies get to pass this information around between each other. If an Australian politician said, well, we believe in a transparent democratic society. What are you doing? We need to know what information are you banding around? What's your, you made a claim. What's your evidence? ASIO just says, sorry, we can't share it with you because we have obligations to our intelligence partners. That's why it's classified. And especially now, it didn't happen in 1973. Gough Whitlam's Attorney General in 73 tried to raid Lionel Murphy, conducted a raid on ASIO, and that definitely that was part of the drumbeat that saw them get rid of Whitlam. But no politician today would have the kahunas to even think about challenging ASIO on that basis. Maybe one, Andrew Wilkie, except Wilkie's kept off the reservation, right? So in practice, Five Eyes has this enormous power that it gets to pump out information that it never has to verify. It tells politicians, oh, there's this threat, there's a cybersecurity threat, there's this other threat, et cetera. You must respond to it. It's the arrangement is dominated not by ASIO but by the big players, CIA and MI6, right? And it just disseminates that here in Australia, and we've documented this in spades for how it works with the recent wave of China disinformation. And nobody that we elect who have the ultimate power because they get to vote, none of them have the wherewithal in them to even question that. And if they don't question that, if they don't demand oversight, right, to say, no, we're going to keep an eye on what you're doing, then that's where the power resides. And Peter Dutton, as the former Home Affairs Minister, he's completely plugged into that. That's why he's such a warmongering buffoon, right? I regard him as the most dangerous politician in Australia. He's spent his career in those circles. In fact, when he became Home Affairs, they took ASIO off the Attorney General's department and put it into his department. So he can he's participated in more Five Eyes events than anyone else. The one bit of oversight that exists is supposed to be the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. That's completely stacked by politicians who call themselves Wolverines because they're so pro-American. They nickname themselves the Wolverines after this 1985 fantasy Cold War movie in America where the Soviets, the commies invade and young teenagers rise up from this high school called the team was called the Wolverines, and they beat the commies, right? And so these Wolverines, they're all on this security, they're all on this this committee that's the only oversight over ASIO, and the chairman is 34-year-old James Patterson, got zero experience, zero qualification in this area except he's a Wolverine. He's a US stooge. That's why he's running this department. He's actually a bigger British stooge than a US stooge. In fact, that's why he's running this committee. Yet we have one of the most experienced intelligence experts in Australia in Parliament, Andrew Wilkie, who doesn't only have experience, he has credibility because he's the guy who quit in 2002 over the lies of the Iraq War. He blew the whistle in Australia. He's in Parliament. He can't get within a ball's roar of that committee. And that's the only oversight. So that structure, it literally hands down orders. And next thing you know, and they're dancing to a conga line. The problem with the Labor Party, they're not when they're not in government, they're not in the mix, so to speak, but they're too gutless, absolutely gutless. They're terrified of being seen to be soft on national security, because that's what people, jerks like Dutton, accuse them of as soon as they take a contrary line. We were really heavily involved in the fight against the Iraq War, Martin. And in 2002, Simon Crean was the opposition leader, and he deserves so much credit for what he did. It was such a courageous act. He led Labor to oppose the Iraq War. And what it made it more courageous than normal is he was going against the superstar of global Labor parties, Tony Blair. Right? Blair was so fanatically pushing that war, and Labor, which is in Australia, which is normally in total lockstep. So under them, Simon Crean said no. Now, we were part of the mix. It's a long story, but we were putting a lot of pressure on Labor at the time and on a bunch of things. But that's what Crean did. It's the last time that Labor has shown any spine like that on this matter. So when it comes to these issues, foreign affairs, global strategic issues, there is no, we are a one-party state for all intents and purposes. And that's why we get involved in this. My media plays a role. Jonathan Kersley, this Channel 9 journalist, about a week, I forget when it was, you know, not that long ago, in the last week, I'm watching this press conference with ScoMo, and he literally says, what are you going to do about Russia massing its troops on Ukraine's border? And I'm like, oh, my God. Even if the politicians had an inclination to butt out, the media are brainwashed to think that somehow we have some role to play, you know, and that's... And unfortunately, they're on the drip feed from ASIO as well. In fact, a top Four Corners producer from yesteryear, Peter, someone might remember his name, in the last few years came out really stridently attacking this about the number of journos who don't practice actual journalism anymore. They practice what he called access journalism, and the chief agency to have access to is ASIO, where they just take ASIO's information without question and put it in the press and disseminate it. And that has driven the national security agenda, the war on terrorism agenda, the anti-China agenda, and now this Russian stuff for the last 20 years.
Right. And just on the terrorism thing, how many people have died from terrorism acts in Australia in the last 5 years? Right. It's a pretty small number. How many people die from asbestos every year? 4,000, right?
There
just
you go.
To put things in context.
A whole different level of alarmism.
I know.
But one can be used to justify the most extreme onerous laws and the other can't.
Exactly right. And that's why, you know, these conversations are really important conversations. I'm sure a lot of people listening won't agree with everything that you've said, Robbie. That's not the point, right? The point is... To raise some of these issues and to help people look at this in some different perspectives. So I want to say thank you for your time tonight. Thanks for your brutal honesty on so much of this.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for being flexible. You can turn on a dime. You're quite extraordinary. So thanks for that. just don't leave Cookie Boy along that this can be nightly.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got the kit to do it, but there is a bit of work that has to be done behind the scenes to make it to all come together. But I thank you for, you know, coming on a very short notice and, you know, being able to take those questions and that conversations. Thanks to all of those in the chat too, and all of the comments and everything. Didn't cover all the questions, but hopefully we got a fair through. And thanks for all those who contributed via the super chat. So
question me on Twitter if you really got a burning question at Robbie Barwick. I'll answer you there.
You could be on there for some time, Robbie. Thank you very much. I'm going to take you offline now, and then I'm going to close the show.
See ya. Thanks, man.
Thanks, bye. So there you go, folks. I hope that you found that useful. You know, the point about this, as I say, is different perspectives, you know, turning the Rubik's Cube. Philosophy enables you to look at things differently, hopefully. So thank you for that. And I want to say that next Tuesday I'll be on with Damien Klassen. And we're going to be talking about the markets and what's happened over the last few days and the next few days, the Fed's latest decision. That'll be next Tuesday. So mark your diaries and make sure that you come on and ask a question there about the markets and what's going on. It should be a very interesting conversation. But I want to say thank you for spending some time on this Wednesday evening. Appreciate it. And I'll look forward to seeing you next Tuesday on the live or otherwise some of my other shows on record in the interim. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Cheerio.